Coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Apropos of Something. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville Resistance Radio, and I like to say Persistence Radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we welcome Aaron Shetterly, narrative historian, fellow with Virginia Humanities. He's a writer and editor who has traveled extensively in Latin America. We'll discuss his recent books. One of them is The Americano, which received rave critical reviews in the largely untold story of a man from Toledo, Ohio, who fought in the Cuban Revolution. And we'll discuss events surrounding the 1979 Greensboro Massacre, the subject of his forthcoming book. The events have particular relevance in our lives today around civil rights, the police, the KKK, and Nazis. And as is usually the case with Aaron's work, there's always a riveting story that most of us never knew about. We'll hear that, and I guarantee you, you'll be on the edge of your seat. And we are very excited to be speaking with Jay Warr, an artist, a musician, and an activist who's trying to create positive change while exchanging smiles and lightness with a diverse team of live performers and often equally diverse audience. He fronts the band Vibe Riot, purveyors of funk, soul, hip-hop, reggae, rock, go-go. They perform all over the place. They were just at Seaville Pride. They'll be at the Tom Tom Fest September 29th at Ix Park. His message, we might not speak the same language, but we can still rock to the same beat. If it ain't one love, it's war. Nancy, it's time to introduce you. How are you?
I am fine. I am fine. I'm just, you know, wondering, as you were actually talking about Mr. Shetterly, I was just wondering, you know, like, he's going to be busy looking through the lens of history of yesterday. He's going to be very busy writing.
Yes.
Writing of the times is my point. Other than that, I will always go for a good dance beat, so I'm very glad.
That's true. You, of all of my friends, love a good dance beat. What do you want to talk about? What has been going on? I heard...
Nothing. That's right. It's just like, I mean, the easy, lazy days of summer. I feel like, you know, we're just getting bonus days now. I can't think... There's, like, nothing going on, you know?
Well, I did hear... So I just flipped on the news. I saw something about a recording in Rosenstein. Just give me a brief idea of what the latest as
now,
of...
that one is...
Is that old?
Well, you're asking my opinion, obviously.
I am.
So that is... To me, a total stunt and a leak on purpose to distract, you know, this whole litany to distract us from Kavanaugh, to distract us from everything else. If you did see Rosenstein when he was in front of the Senate, whatever committee, he does have a sense of humor. He does like a little sarcasm. And apparently, I totally believe it. When you read that line that he just he said to, McCabe, what do you want me to do, Andy, wear a wire? You know, I mean, it was so obviously mm-hmm. just a joke, mm-hmm. you know, and of course, and it's all they need. That's all, you know, like they're not even going to need a reason to let Rosenstein go or fire Rosenstein for, the fact sometimes that they go to these lengths and they plant sources, you know, they're the first ones. Like, they don't believe the failing New York Times. Do you want my opinion, Ellen? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
I know.
Well, I just want, yeah, because
anyway, so
I didn't know it was going on.
It's all irony.
So my
hypocrisy.
Very sappy hashtag, I don't know, it came up with is Kavanaugh. What do you
yes,
think?
Yes, Kavanaugh. Excuse me, I don't mean to get the last one. Yes,
yeah,
I know. It's.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
yes, he is the embodiment of, you know, when you're a star, they let you do Trump's line, you know. He is just getting he's just getting away with everything. I mean, it wasn't enough when it started, you know.
But I will say that it looked hopeless for our side until recently, so I have a little bit of hope. I really try to tune in when there's good news, which is so never, because I'm a little bit worn down by it. But I have a tiny bit of hope. Tiny bit. Oh, so will you remind people what number to call about that?
The Senate? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. Let me, yes. Please. It doesn't even call your senators and call any of them. That's what I do. Just pick, you know, they're all going to be voting, you know, the Republicans. So anyway, yes, there's a couple numbers, 202-804-8191 mm-hmm. and 202-224-3121. And, you know.
It does matter.
Huh?
It does matter. It does matter to call.
It does. I mean, I have personally given up on Susan Collins, but, you know, go ahead and call her, mm-hmm. too. Call Murkowski and Heitkamp and Manchin and Donnelly and yours and anyone, you know.
Yes. Just to turn to what's going on in Seville, and let's get on with the amazing people we have before us here. Some events. Sunday, 9:23 at the UVA Rotunda. This is open to the public. The amazing Jeff Cox is doing a conflict resolution session called Conflict is Good News, Mindfulness and Conflict Resolution. It's a short talk, a meditative practice session, and time for discussion. More info at uvacontemplation.org. And the Latin American Cultural Festival every year is held every year here in Seville. It will be Sunday, October 7. And then right to the show, I want to get right to it. We have with us Aaron Shetterly. He is a narrative historian, author of The Americano, fellow with Virginia Humanities. Americano received rave critical reviews. It's the largely untold story of a man from Ohio who fought in the Cuban Revolution. To quote the National Book Award winner Carlos Iyer, The Americano is history at its best, a brilliant, fast-paced account based on solid research that reads like a great epic novel. As engaging as it is revealing, the narrative opens up history of the Cuban Revolution from within as no other English language book has ever done. We're also going to talk about the Greensboro Massacre of 79. So welcome to the show, Aaron.
It's great to be here. I hope I can say something apropos of something.
Yes.
You did. You're in.
You're in.
You qualified.
Yeah, you're in.
That's it.
You know, of all the shows we've had, no one has
have
really
you
said
met
that.
Us? I'm sorry, Ellen.
No one's really even said that. You would think people have said that before, so... Once again, pointing to your, you know, brilliance. So tell us about William Morgan. He is the guy from Toledo, Ohio. So during the Cuban Revolution, he helped Fidel Castro's victory against the dictator at the time, Batista, in, I believe, 1957. And Che Guevara later joined his forces. I don't know. I'd like to spin that to that Che was inspired. But you can let us know if that was true by William Morgan. What was going on in Cuba in 57?
So... When I discovered this story of William Morgan, it was sort of from an offhand comment when I was in Cuba, looking at Cuban art, and a man in the Cuban government responded to a question I asked. I said, "Well, I had studied the Spanish Civil War, and there were the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and the International Brigades who had gone there to fight fascism in Spain." In the 30s, and I asked if there had been anything like that in Cuba in the 50s, when Fidel Castro and others rose up against the dictator Fulgencio Batista. And he said, no, but there was this one man, what was his name? Oh, William Morgan. And I took that name back and submitted Freedom of Information Act requests to the CIA and FBI and got these stacks of documents back, half of which were redacted completely. And I thought, I have to know what's under that blacked out portions. Turns out Morgan was this sort of ne'er-do-well, really. He was born to an upper middle class family in Toledo, Ohio, but had never fit in, had bumped around, been dishonorably discharged from the U.S. military after going AWOL from in Japan, where he was part of the occupying force after World War II, ended up getting involved with some gangsters who were selling weapons to the Cuban rebels fighting against Batista. and went to Cuba and got in with a group of revolutionaries who were based in the center of the country. So just a quick geography. Fidel Castro was on the far eastern end of the island in a section called, or a mountain area called the Sierra Maestra. What was interesting, what I began to learn as I dug into this history, is how many different groups there were organizing against Batista. There were several. And so what emerged in the story was an idea of both what the fight against the dictator was, but then what the struggle was to see who would win the revolution once they had kicked Batista out of the country. Who would get to run what the new Cuba was going to be, and Fidel Castro won that. But going to your point about Che Guevara, which is sort of this, unfortunately, Che was not at all inspired by Morgan, nor Morgan by Che. They were sort of arch enemies of sorts. But there were only two foreigners in the Cuban rebel army that held the rank of comandante or major. One was Che Guevara, who we've all heard of. And the other was this guy, William Morgan from Toledo, Ohio, whose story had been completely lost, whereas Che has become, you know, an icon of revolution. Morgan was actually more famous for a time in Cuba in 59 than Che was, but his star fell when he turned against Castro in 1960.
I know he was obviously American. Why did it go south with Castro, since obviously, he was down there fighting for the cause?
So when he first joined up, he wrote this sort of letter full of typos, but sort of very heartfelt letter that he sent to the New York Times that said, why is America propping up a dictator here in Cuba? This is against our ideals. And he was trying to explain why he had joined these rebels. And he said, already Batista was trying to say that the people fighting against him were communists. And Morgan said, these are not communists. And the people he was fighting with were really serious social democrats who were steeped in sort of a philosophy of social democracy. And so when the Cuban government under Fidel started to turn to a more hardline sort of communist approach, and particularly started to shut down the freedom of the press in early 1960, and were pushing people who disagreed with them out of positions in the government and other positions, he began to have doubts, as did a lot of the other people that he had fought with. And so at that point, it's sort of a complicated story, but he had had his U.S. citizenship removed by J. Edgar Hoover in the State Department for having been on Castro's side. And so he didn't really have anywhere to go. And so when he started to disagree with Castro, instead of just leaving, with his Cuban wife and two young Cuban children at that point, he decided to start organizing and arming, helping to arm people who are rising up against Castro in the middle of the island. And he got caught moving arms into the center of the island where he had fought before. One of the things that I also learned, as well as the fact that there were multiple groups fighting against Batista, was that after Castro and the others won the revolution, I came across this amazing quote by Raul Castro, which said, after we won the revolution, we had to win a civil war. And really, that civil war lasted until 1965, and Morgan was part of the early months of it.
Wasn't he, I don't know if you mentioned this already, but I read a little bit about how he really was interested in protecting freedom, and that was, what was his motivation for going?
I think his more personal motivation for going was really that he was this person who'd been at loose ends and was looking for, a purpose and meaning in his own life. And what was clear was that he had this sort of rambunctious, vociferous style that never really fit in at home in Toledo. And he got to Cuba and he talked with his hands. He talked loudly. He told jokes and he got along with the Cubans. He really fit with them. And I think for the first time, he really felt like he was at home. Mm-hmm. And I think that was part of it. I think the freedom part came through, was transmitted to him through these Cubans who were deeply committed to what they were fighting for. And he picked up on it and, you know, knew enough about sort of the ideals and the best in the sense of possibilities of American history to have a grounding in what they were talking about and then move that forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the spirit of the usual conspiracy theories, once he was disillusioned with what he was, realized he wasn't actually fighting for anymore, do you think he flipped? Do you think he was working for the CIA at the end? Or no?
Great question. I mean, that's a question that has troubled a lot of people. I had the interesting good fortune to meet with Philip Agee. Does that name ring a bell? He wrote a book called Inside the Company, in which he revealed who CIA operatives were around the world. This book came out in what? Late 60s, early 70s, I guess, and basically fled American authority from that point until the end of his life. He lived in Germany for a while and then ended up living for a long, long time until he died a few years ago, I think, in Cuba. And so he had been a CIA guy, and I sat down with him and I asked him, I said, was Morgan a member of the CIA? And he said, no, he wouldn't have been. But he said, could he have used CIA support once he flipped, as you're suggesting, Nancy? And he said, listen, people who are sure of what they want to do will take resources from anywhere and anyone who wants to give it to them. And that the fact that he may have received some weapons or something from the CIA doesn't necessarily mean that he was working for the CIA in any real way.
Gotcha.
Interesting.
How did you research this? This is still Cuba. You know, I know we're still not exactly best friends. So how was it difficult to research this project?
It was difficult in both places, both in Cuba and in Miami, where I spent a lot of the time researching it. You know, one of the reasons that Morgan's story got lost is because it didn't fit either of the sort of simple narratives and opposing narratives. In Miami, he was considered a communist supporter of Fidel Castro by a lot of people, therefore untrustworthy. In Cuba, he got branded as a CIA agent and a traitor. That's what made me think he was actually a really good subject to write about, because he sort of erased by both sides. So in Cuba, I spent 6 months there digging around. I got some interviews, some really good information. I got kicked out of a town where I was interviewing old rebels who then called the Interior Ministry and said, I think this American's a CIA agent. And the Interior Ministry sent someone up and said, I think you should take the next bus out of town. And I said, well, I've got a few more interviews to do. I'll take the next bus after that bus. And they said, no, you're not understanding me. You're taking the next bus out of town.
Very interesting. Well, you're listening to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Aaron Shetterly. We're going to be right back with more very interesting anecdotes. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. It's 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Aaron Shetterly. He is an author of the book Americano and an upcoming book on the Greensboro Massacre, which we're going to get to. I wanted to just round it out, because so we have time to talk about all those other things. What actually, what eventually happened? How would you round up the story about William Morgan?
So Morgan was actually running a big frog farm in...
Literally?
Literally. They had a nursery for bullfrogs, and they were selling the frog legs, actually. I mean, this is interesting, 60 to the United States to restaurants, and making belts and purses. And
the evil Americans?
Yeah. Employing a lot of people and making these handbags and belts and things, wallets out of the frog skin. And one day he went to deliver a one of the high-ranking of government officials, a guy named Juan Almeida, was going to get married, and Morgan brought him this beautiful handbag for his as a wedding present for his wife. And as he walked into the man's Juan Almeida's office, they arrested him and put him in prison because at this point he had been moving some guns into the mountains. And so Morgan hadn't killed anybody. He didn't have any blood on his hands, but he was one of the last most sort of well-known and charismatic rebel leaders, opposition rebel leaders left in the country. And he was in jail for several months. There was a trial. He was convicted. And immediately after that trial, he was executed in March of 1961. Now, what's important about that moment is for months at that point, the Cubans knew that what became the Bay of Pigs, an invasion was coming. And they also knew that the plans for the invasion were to land a force on the coast of Cuba to meet up with an internal force. And they were terrified that Morgan would be the kind of person who could actually make that happen from the inside of Cuba. And so they got him out of the way. And the Bay of Pigs happened. The internal force never came together and never met the force landing on the beaches. And the rest is history. I mean, that was a tremendous loss that had repercussions throughout American history and Cuban history.
So again, this book is The Americano. I expected a copy, Aaron, when you were here. So, no,
I owe you one.
It sounds amazing, and I will get it myself. I can't wait to actually look through it. I wanted to ask you about a segue that we can make to the next topic, Americans Who Tell the Truth, or Americans Who Told the Truth. Tell us a little bit about that project, and then we'll get right into Greensboro.
So my father's a painter, and he was a sort of a surrealist painter until 2002 in the build-up to the Iraq War. And he felt like he needed to use his artistic voice to be more direct about his citizenship. And but he wasn't sure what to do, and he was frustrated. And he had all these quotes from people he admired and quotes that inspired him tacked up on his studio wall. And he saw one from Walt Whitman and decided to paint a portrait of Walt Whitman. Painted a portrait of Walt Whitman, felt a little better for a few days, started to get revved up again. And his wife said to him, why don't you paint another portrait? And he painted Frederick Douglass, and he felt a little better for a few days. And now we're at about 242 or three portraits at this point that he has painted over the last 16 years of people who have fought for social, economic, or environmental justice throughout American history.
That's amazing. And we can see them at that website, Americans Who
Tell the Truth.org.
So tell us how that connects with this event that happened in 1979, where four or five people were killed in what's known as the Greensboro Massacre.
So in 2015, a show of, I think, 52 of these portraits was going up in the International Civil Rights Center and Museum in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I went with him, and my wife and I went with him down to Greensboro. And the woman who organized that said, you know, you really need to meet Reverend Nelson Johnson and his wife Joyce while you're here. And so we went over to this little cafe called Manny's Universal Cafe, run by a Salvadoran woman in Greensboro, and Reverend Johnson and Joyce Johnson arrived, and we started talking, and he started telling me stories about the history of Greensboro and his participation in this late civil rights history that I didn't know anything about. And I walked out of that meeting with the hair standing up on the back of my neck, really thinking, holy smokes, here's another story about moral and physical courage coming together. And I'm drawn to these sort of complicated stories that don't, in a sense, have a tidy ending, that keep going. And I started thinking at that moment, maybe there's something to work on here. And so it led me to the research and eventually to deciding to write a book about the Greensboro Massacre and the Johnsons.
Is that going to be the direction, them? Is it too early to know exactly how you're going to, you know?
Their long history, I think, and what they thought they were doing and the way that they have tried to, in a sense, find the proper tools to work for social and economic justice, racial justice, I think is going to be a core part of the story. There will be a lot of other characters. I'll try to represent the different sides and aspects of this story well. But
just want to mention we're going to be speaking with Jaywar, an artist, musician, activist, very soon. Just a little plug there. Stay tuned for Jaywar. We're really looking forward to that. So back to the story. So can you just lay out for us there, as I understand it, the thing that started this, there were a bunch of events that one led to the other. There was labor organizing activities at a mill, trying to bring black and white people together. And then there was a divide to try to, just for profit, I believe, as you had explained to me, to drive them apart. And a lot of tensions, racial tensions. Can you just give us sort of the bullet points? What happened that led to the massacre, all of these events?
So, a multinational or multiracial group of people who had been studying Marxism together were organizing the mill workers in the mills in the Piedmont area around Greensboro. There were several mills that they were involved in. They were trying to bridge the gap between white and black workers and were finding that very difficult. In part because there was a lot of interference being run, some of which perhaps was being done by the Klan. And so one of the responses was thinking, well, let's try to put this history into context. Let's try to demystify a little bit what's going on here and give people the courage and the sort of intellectual tools to work together instead of being, you know, frightened by what's happening. And so they organized this march that was, they ended up calling, it was a anti-Klan march, but one of the slogans that they used was death to the Klan, which was provocative. And the march was going to go wind its way through a number of housing projects in Greensboro and then end in a conference. And they fully expected several hundred people, white and black, to come to this from all over the South, including some from Virginia. And it was probably going to be one of the largest labor or organizing moments in North Carolina since the 30s. And as they're setting up, a caravan of Klansmen and neo-Nazis drove up, 9 cars, and there was a brief stick fight, and then Klan and Nazis started pulling guns out of the trunk of one of the cars and shot 5 of the leaders of this group. And it's important that they were the leaders that were shot, which is interesting and creates a sort of a ripple effect about how this gets thought of. And Nelson Johnson, who organized the march, the man I met and heard part of this story from, was stabbed, but not killed. There were then 3 trials coming out of this. There was a state criminal trial. All of this was captured on videotape. I mean, we think about this, it's 1979. There are 4 news crews. It's all videotaped. They can see what's happening, who's shooting whom, all of that. state murder trial, all are acquitted. Federal civil rights trial, all are acquitted. Finally, a federal civil trial. And for the first time in American history, police officers, Klansmen, and Nazis were all found liable together for wrongful death.
Mm-hmm. And that was in 85 or so?
Mm-hmm. Were they acquitted? Yes.
I mean, in the civil trial, which wouldn't lead to prison time, there was a financial settlement that was paid in full by the city of Greensboro for all parties.
So what is the story that put your hair on end?
So one of the things that really interested me was how did this man, this African-American man who had become, moved from Pan-Africanism to Black Power to communism, end up becoming a pastor?
This guy Johnson.
Nelson Johnson. Mm-hmm. And he told me this story that took place in 1987, so 8 years after the massacre. And he had basically been a pariah in Greensboro for these years, hadn't been able to get a job, as had a lot of these people, and decided eventually to go to seminary. He went to seminary in Richmond, and he would drive up to Richmond during the week and drive home for the weekend to spend time with his wife and daughters. And while he was in seminary, he began to get this glimpse of a radical Christ that felt like someone he could follow, and he began to think also that the language of Christianity was going to be more effective for social change in the United States than the language of communism. But what happened was the Klan said that they were going to march in Greensboro in 1987. And he thought, whoa, wait a minute. I don't think that's a good idea. And so he was trying to figure out what to do. And he went and he talked to his teachers at the seminary. And they said to him, I don't think you should do anything about it. Some people are beyond the pale, was the word they use. And he couldn't justify this with the sort of the Christian teachings that he had been really taking to heart in seminary. He thought, I have to believe in the possible transformation of every person. So he went home and he had a long conversation with his wife and he said, you know, I'm going to drive out and I'm going to ask them not to come. So he got in his car and drove 70 miles into rural North Carolina by himself, drove up to a trailer that had a big sign on the driveway leading up to the trailer that said, no N-word welcome here. Drove up and ended up having a conversation, a long conversation, with these Klansmen about history, about what they were doing, about what they were trying to accomplish, whether they could work together on different economic issues or not. And the fact that listening to the story and the courage it took and the fear, his own fear, that he had to overcome in order to do it. And it just illustrated to me this level of commitment to trying to create a bridge, to trying to find a way through some of these divides that I felt was worth exploring more deeply.
And just one little part of that story that I appreciated. Can you talk about the side of the road moment he had?
So he's driving there and he gets really quite terrified, too terrified to keep driving at one point. So he pulls over to the side of the road and he's trying to collect himself. And he looks out and he sees the trees around him and the leaves on the trees. And he thinks just how beautiful they are. And all of a sudden, this verse from Philippians comes to him, and it said, finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are good, report if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think of these things. So he thought of those things, and it calmed him down. What's interesting about that story, in a way, is when he told me that story, he said, it must have been fall because the leaves had so much color. And then I went and I looked at the dates, and I went back to him, and I said, I don't think it could have been fall. He said, oh, yeah, maybe it was April. And I said, well, April, well, how could the leaves be so colorful to get his attention? So I drove down to Greensboro and was driving around on that same route that he took in early April, just as the leaves were coming out on the trees. And one of the things you don't realize is how colorful leaves are when they're first emerging in the spring. They aren't green. They were ochre. They were yellow. The eastern redbud was blooming. And so I suddenly understood why he saw so much color and why he would remember it, perhaps, as being fall colors.
Thank you so much. We look forward to that book. We can find it probably when it's out on your website, which is it Aaron Shetterly? Is it .org?
.com.
.com. Google Aaron with an A. It's A-R-A-N. Thank you so much. We look forward to perhaps talking with you again. And we're going to go to a hard break, and we will be right back with Jaywar, an artist, musician, activist, who is spreading love and spreading a good work throughout Seville and the rest of the U.S. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. Welcome back, everyone. We had a short break because we want to get right to Jaywar. He is here with us. Nancy, take it for a moment while I just fiddle with some dials. Take it.
That sounds dangerous.
Do you have a news of note? I have one that I can make short.
No, I'd rather...
You'd rather get right to it?
I'd rather ask
Good idea.
A question than
okay.
do a news of note. I think he is the news of note.
Okay. He is the news of note. That is so good. I'm hearing like all this feedbacky stuff. Can you hear it? Okay.
Well,
so,
that's
Jaywar.
Probably me. I am feedback. Okay, Mr. Jaywar.
How you doing?
I'll do
Jaywar.
The
Wait, I'm going to introduce him.
Question.
No, can I introduce him?
Huh?
I want to introduce him.
All righty.
All right. He needs an introduction to our folks who don't already know of him.
Doing knobs. Okay.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Well, your time is over. So Jaywar is an artist, musician, activist who's trying to create positive change while, as he says, exchanging smiles and lightness with a diverse team of live performers and often equally diverse audience. I just love that. He fronts the band Vibe Riot, purveyors of funk, soul, hip-hop, reggae, rock, go-go. They perform all over the place, as I said before, upcoming concert September 29th. Now, welcome to the show, Jaywar.
Who is this we're talking about?
You.
Oh, I'm just kidding.
And I know you said we can call you Jay, so if that's okay, we'll do that too.
Yes, thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. So, Nancy, why don't you start off the interview?
Well, okay. You know what? There's no time for this back and forth. Yes, I was curious, Jaywar. What is your background, and how did you arrive at music as the thing you want to do?
It's been a lifelong desire. I grew up listening to the old reggae records from my dad, and just it's always been around. It's always been a part of my life, and so as I got a little older and started choosing my own music, I also got attracted to hip hop mainly, and R&B and soul, and it grew on me. I'm kind of an introvert. I don't know if that's obvious, but so that's my way of kind of expressing and connecting with the world as I see it.
What happens when, you know, a lot of introverts say that they're comedians or they're actors or musicians. So what is it about music that does it for you, that allows you to have such a big voice, good voice?
You kind of lose yourself in it, in the art, I guess. And so you're stepping outside of what you think of as your normal self, I guess, and exploring. So I'm also an engineer, so I'm a very logical, however you want to say, thinker. And the music is where I allow myself to be emotional and kind of explore my emotions, the emotions of people around me or politics, history. And it feels like a part of me, but a realm that I only really explore fully through my art.
Are you always writing, or are you regimented? What's your process?
My process is all over the place. So usually I feel like my best writing comes when I'm supposed to be doing something else.
Like, are you doing it now? Is that what's happening?
Well, this might be the one time where I can't. It has to be something that it takes enough of my attention, but I can almost do it on autopilot. And then all of a sudden, the lyrics will interrupt. Almost, maybe interrupt is a bad word. The words will come to me as I'm doing that other thing. And a lot of times I lose a lot of lyrics. I've lost whole songs where I might have been driving or doing something else, and I've memorized the full verse, thinking as soon as I get to the place where I can write it down, I've got this full verse, almost a whole song, and then I've lost so many that way, you know? But then sometimes they come back, you know?
What are you most inspired these days with everything that is going around on now to write about?
It's always the same thing. I feel like everything falls into love and politics. And so love is always a big topic for me to write about. And politics, love it or hate it, is everything else. It's everything else. So those things I'm constantly writing about.
How did you find, or how did you all find each other? How did Vibe Riot happen?
The internet, Craigslist.
Oh, yeah.
So I had some good experience with other bands as a guest and had so much fun. I was a solo artist up until, maybe a couple years before Vibe Riot. And I had producers I was working with, and eventually somehow just made friends with a band at a show, keep going to one of their shows, and they just somehow figured out one of the guys was to come around in the crowd with the mic and get people to sing along with whatever songs they were singing, and that happened a few times, and then he was like, oh, you can sing, and eventually that led to him throwing me on stage, and then that just kept happening consistently, and then eventually I got invited to some big shows and festivals with them, and it got to a point where I was like, I gotta have my own band. And so just got on Craigslist and met some musicians who introduced me to more musicians, and the rest is kind of history.
So you said I know music's always been important to you. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how your background influenced you and where you grew up and the role of your father?
So my dad's from Jamaica, and so all the old school Bob Marley, Oswald, Steel Pulse, all the old school reggae bands and artists, Gregory Isaacs, all the classic guys, roots reggae. That's what I grew up listening to for the longest, for as long as I can remember, and so that the heavy bass lines, heavy drums, all of that has stuck with me ever since. And so naturally, hip hop kind of feeds off of that. I think before hip hop, they were kind of sampling a lot of those old funk, soul, and reggae songs anyway. So it's kind of a derivative in some ways before it became its own thing. And I just got, as a kid, I saw images of some of these hip hop artists, some of these rappers that just seemed so powerful. And those images just kind of like stick in your brain, right? And so as I got more and more interested in music, those images, the familiar images, the Bob Marleys and the LL Cool J's, kind of equally kept and drew my attention. And I really was impressed with the way a lot of rappers put their lyrics together, how they could, the double meanings, how you could say one line, it could be taken three different ways. And so in school, I got into poetry. Even from grade school, took classes with Nikki Giovanni at Virginia Tech. So I was always honing my performance and my writing, and even alongside as me becoming an engineer, like it was always there. You know, my parents said you can't put all your eggs in one basket. You can't just do music. So my dad taught me that math and science and English were the most important things that a person could learn. So along with my music, those three topics led me to become an engineer.
Great.
And as far as role models back then, I know obviously you just have said, there's Bob Marley and LL Cool J. I was wondering, do you have musical influences now? Are there any?
You mean like more current artists that I like?
Yeah.
I like The Roots. a very good hip hop band. The Anderson .Paak. Mine draws a blank right now,
okay.
but yeah, there's a lot of old school artists that I still listen to now. Nas, Jay-Z, Lauryn Hill, and the new school artists. There's fewer of them, but the ones that I do like have a big influence on me. Yeah.
You're selective about who you like.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I feel like everything you consume becomes a part of you, and so I'm very picky. Mm. Like I listen to a little bit of everything, but you know, and I can appreciate the art and even the music that I'll tell you that I don't like. I can appreciate elements of it, but I don't necessarily want to spend a lot of hours, you know, being kind of washed over by that. So I pick and choose, you know, mm-hmm. what's in my space.
I know you have mentioned hip hop and reggae and soul and funk. And I saw on your website that what your music is not is something that I had not heard of, and I admit. So what is mumble pop and why is it bad? Let me know. I need to know.
So I shouldn't say it's bad. it's just not my favorite kind of music. So I feel like
let's get into it.
Every music has its purpose, right? And mumble pop, I would describe as if I'm in a club, having a few drinks, not paying attention to what's being said, I could care less. They could be playing that. But if it's a setting where, you know, where I'm actually able to focus on the words, mumble pop just falls in the category where they're not necessarily saying anything that I find very interesting. Mm. Like, words are rhyming. Sometimes those words can be, in my opinion, harmful to those who don't understand what they're listening and can't put it in perspective. But at the same time, like, I try very hard not to judge artists, right? And so, you know, just because I don't like it and I feel like it might not be appropriate to everybody, there's movies like that aren't appropriate to every audience. And do I think those movies are bad? No, I still think they have their place. But, you know, just a certain audience might not be able to put that into perspective, and that can have maybe repercussions, maybe not, you know. And so mumble pop is just, I feel like it's not what I do. I feel like I have music that's very entertaining and sonically pleasing, but I feel like if you get into my lyrics, you'll find substance there. And I feel like what I call mumble pop really has no substance, you know.
It makes you're not saying to ban it. You're just saying you don't like it.
And also, you're defining it for us. It makes perfect sense once you explain it. Because I think we all know what that means. Just lyrics that have no meaning whatsoever. It's like the opposite.
Well, and let me say something too. Like, I feel like when I was younger, I've made music that I would not make today, and so I don't want to. I try very hard not to be too critical because, you know, there's a saying by Malcolm X, I'm going to totally tear it apart, but, you know, you shouldn't put somebody down or judge somebody too harshly for not knowing better, you know, today. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because you might have been in a similar position yesterday, you know?
Right. Very, very gracious. Yeah. Gracious.
Yes, exactly. You're being very gracious about it, and I'm now going to switch topics because I feel like this is time. We've given it too much space.
The mumble.
in terms of Vibe Fest, speaking of, you know, the idea of strengthening the community and the love aspect of all your lyrics, how did you get involved with that? I know you're the director now, so how did that happen?
I just saw an opportunity where there's a lot of good. There's a lot of good artists here in Charlottesville, and I feel like I don't know what the process is for all the different festivals or how, you know, every musician makes it. I'm pretty sure it's different for all of us, but I just feel like I know a lot of great artists that don't get the same performing opportunities that I see other artists get. And so I wanted to create something where I could give a platform to some of these artists. And at the same time, I feel like there's another angle to a lot of these festivals and events where you're bringing people together. And so Like I mentioned earlier, like everything, even when you don't think it is, everything is political. And so, like, when you're bringing people together and you're not really including certain people, whether you think, you know, whether that's your point, your purpose, if it's consistently leaving certain people out, that's political. And being ignorant of that doesn't really excuse it. So it's not me being mad at anybody, but I saw opportunity where, hey, I don't feel like certain important needs are being met with some of these other festivals, and I think I know how to do that. And while doing that, I think I also know some great artists that are not getting the spotlight that, hey, now I can not only bring people together and give them something different and give them something that's quality, you know, like I can also do it right, you know. And so that's kind of what drove me eventually to say, you know, instead of waiting for somebody else to create this, I know how to do this. I have some of the, you know, resources and know-how. So I'm going to make it my responsibility.
And you guys as well, as Vibe Riot, right? You've been, well, tell us, actually, where have you guys have performed at some very socially aware events?
Yeah, we performed for the Women's March a few Januaries back. We've done Planned Parenthood fundraisers. I like to think of my Vibe Fest as in the same vein. Just some other smaller gigs have come up too, but it was the same idea where they wanted to bring the community together. They wanted to celebrate diversity, and they asked us to perform, and we're always, you know, happy to do those kind of events the most.
Yeah, like the Floyd Fest, African American Heritage Festivals, the Grant Awards, which transforms, I mean, they all have like amazing causes. And so I really appreciate that you're performing in all these places. That, do you find that not many other artists are doing that? That's my impression.
I don't know how to answer that.
Okay. Well, I think it's fantastic that you're doing it. That's the point I wanted to make.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, like, we talked about, you know, how social media was so important to how you guys all connected. What about for your, you know, for Vibe Riot and for whatever, you know, if you do solo stuff, how is social media a part of, how does it play into your music?
So I've got a couple different social media outlets, and I try to focus mostly on the band because I feel like that it includes a lot of different angles and backgrounds. And my stuff, I've had material out there longer, so I still maintain it. And I haven't been doing a lot of solo work, but every now and then I will release something there, or if I'm doing an interview, you know, that gets captured somehow, I might make note of it on the more personal page. So that's kind of how I split things, I guess. If it feels slightly more personal, then I might use my solo artist social media presence, and then anything that's including others will probably, and the band will go on those pages.
And so, J-War, where is your next gig? Where can people see you? And follow up, where can people find you online?
Tom Tom on September 29th. We'll be performing there at Ixart Park. I'm working on something. I'm probably going to be announcing it later today or within the next couple of days with the Jefferson. That's going to take place in November. So
the Jefferson venue as opposed to the school?
The Jefferson Theater.
Jefferson, great.
Mm-hmm. My website is how people can find it, vibriot.com. I have a page on there for all our performances that are upcoming, and so that's the best way to find everything and stay in touch.
Great. And we'll put your websites on the 94.7 website as well.
Thank you.
On the show site. So
I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It was really great to meet you.
Likewise.
Yeah, come back.
Will do.
Okay. Not mumbling, by the
cool.
way.
So Nancy, without further ado.
Over again.
Yes. No. Yes. Without further ado. Hold on.
All right. Yeah. Are you doing?
It's time for the palate cleanser. people. We have like a minute, so I'm gonna. Well, can I go first?
I was gonna say that myself.
Okay, so I hope these guys stick around just for a few minutes, so I can chat with them after the show. But this is so cool. I think. Have you ever heard of this Danish word called hygge?
No.
It's hard to translate, but it is the Danish concept of being really cozy. That's the best way to translate it. I heard about it, and I've been asking people. No one knows about this, or a lot of people don't know about it. It's this. So apparently, people from Denmark are one of the happiest in the world. That is despite that they're being taxed 60% of their income, which they do willingly because they have health coverage. And they are in virtual darkness for 6 months from October to March. The summers are short, and someone had said that summer is like their favorite day of the year. So hygge is spelled H-Y-G-G-E, and it's just feeling of cozy and contentment. And it's supposedly talked about all the time there in Denmark because it's so important. It's an integral part of their national DNA, it was said. And it just keeps them in, it's like a survival tool to keep them happy. So it's doing things like having a warm cup of coffee. They drink a lot of coffee, which I love. You know, just knitting or sitting there reading a book when it's raining. It's that idea of creating a cozy, cozy environment.
Goodness.
Isn't that great?
I'm sure that I should put an umlaut on both of my O's there. That sounds very nice.
Yeah,
of course.
It's cool.
I'm surprised they actually let that out. They should keep all that stuff secret because we'll colonize it.
Yeah,
you know,
there's a ton there. I mean, like, they're obsessed with lighting and getting that just that perfect mood lighting and all that. So what do you got?
Well, mine's much more sour, I just want to say. I was watching the Emmys, and Capital One, their credit card, they ran one of their usual unspectacular commercials about cash back and all of that, but for some inexplicable reason, they used Prince's song, Let's Go Crazy. I mean, it's Prince. I mean, what is the symbol to encapsulate how wrong that is? Anyway, and of course, what's the decision making at Capital One to sign off on it? But it's such a, and if that just wasn't, you know, inane enough, it's just such a horrible message for a credit card company. Let's go crazy. So this to me signals to, if Jay Warner is still there, to all the musical geniuses out there, get your affairs in order because this is going to happen to your music when it's too late.
Yeah, laughter ensues from Jay Warner.
Whatever is in the wallet of Prince's affairs manager, obviously it's a lot of cash.
Yeah.
That's all I got to say.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Our theme music is by Springtide. Next week, we'll be back with another amazing pair of guests. See you next week, and thank you, Nance.
Yep.
Thanks so much.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Yeah.
Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.